Good evening, everybody. I hope that I'm audible all the way in the back and that you can hear me clearly. I'm delighted to see everyone this late in the quarter because I realize from the crowds at places like Starbucks that the students are already going into hiding and beginning to study for finals. And of course, graduation is right around the corner. So we deeply appreciate your coming out in late May for the final event of this year in the Herman P. and Sophia Taubman Foundation Endowed Symposium in Jewish Studies at UCSB. I'm Leonard Wallach. I'm the program coordinator. And over the last 10 years, the Taubman Symposium has brought to our campus and our community a remarkable array of speakers and performers who are doing work of great distinction in the field of Jewish studies. Before introducing tonight's speaker, I want to give you a brief preview of our events for the fall 2007. First, on Sunday afternoon, October 21, we'll be presenting Gershom Gorenberg, who's the author of Shalom Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, which was the winner of the National Jewish Book Award. Also, The End of Days, his book on fundamentalism and the struggle for the Temple Mount, and most recently, his very widely acclaimed critical success, The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements from 1967 to 1977. Then, on Thursday evening, November 7th, we'll present a conversation and book signing with the award-winning Israeli novelist, David Grossman, and he'll be in conversation with one of my colleagues, Richard Hecht, from the Department of Religious Studies at UCSB. And then finally, on Sunday afternoon, December 9th, Michael Oren, who's the author of Six-Day War, June 1967, and the Making of the Modern Middle East, and also the New York Times bestseller, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America in the Middle East, will be talking about his best-selling book and signing copies of it. So in the fall, our focus will be definitely on Israel and the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy, and we very much hope to see you then. Tonight, our distinguished guest speaker is Larry Garber, who's the executive director and the CEO of the New Israel Fund. Garber spent 5 years as the director of the United States Agency for International Development's West Bank and Gaza mission. So he's been on the ground there, and he knows the situation extremely well. Previously, he was senior policy advisor and deputy assistant administrator of the Bureau of Policy and Program Coordination at the United States AID. He was also a senior associate at the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, which was from 1988 to 1993, during which time he was involved in organizing international elections as an observer and leading to historic governmental change. And finally, he served as an advisor to a number of governments on election reform issues, before which he was legal director of the International Human Rights Law Group from 1983 to 1988. Tonight, his talk is entitled Post-Hava Nagila, Defining a New Relationship with Israel. Please join me in welcoming Larry Garber.
Thank you very much, Leonard, for that kind introduction. And I'm very honored to be here with you this evening, particularly knowing and admiring many of the luminaries who have preceded me to this lectern, and also being very impressed with the program that you announced for the fall. I'm wondering if I could apply for admissions here at UC Santa Barbara. I'm also very grateful for the topic, despite the fact that I don't make any claims to being a sociologist or an expert on the American Jewish community. Indeed, my own interactions with the organized American Jewish communities is rather limited and recent. Before taking this job with the New Israel Fund in 2004, my professional career had focused, as Leonard described in the introduction, on issues relating to human rights, democracy, development, but always on countries other than Israel. Indeed, except for the time that I spent working with USAID in the Palestinian territories, I had not spent extensive time living in Israel between 1974, when I was a student at the Hebrew University, and 1999, when I returned to work as a diplomat or a government official for the United States government. Tonight's topic also is quite timely, and as you see on the chairs, the next week will be marking the 40th anniversary of the Six-Day War. In June 1967 and the months thereafter, Israel's overwhelming military victory not only shifted the balance of power within the Middle East, but also represented an awakening for American Jews and for Jews in other parts of the world. I was a sixth grader at the time of the Six-Day War, and was involved as a in a Jewish community, attending a Jewish day school. And until the Six-Day War, Israel was not really very much a part of our consciousness in a day-to-day sense. And yet I remember soon after the war, the rabbi in our synagogue left on Aliyah, as well as several members of our community, and Israel became much more a focus of our attention in the Jewish day school studies where I attended. Today, we debate internally whether to celebrate this tremendous victory or to bemoan the fact that it has started what has now become a 40-year occupation. And again, we'll hear a lot in the next coming days in the media and elsewhere about this difference in perspective, and a lot of the commemorations will come out on one side or the other of that fault line. My basic thesis this evening is that today there's a much more mature relationship, that it's no longer based on a romanticized view of Israel, or even of an Israel that's solely under siege, but is based on a much more appreciated and refined view of what Israel is, and what the United States and American Jewish relationship to this country should be. So let me set the stage for my presentation by reviewing a few of the developments of the past year in the context of discussions about Israel. About a year and a half ago, there was an article released by Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer that attained a lot of attention and notoriety. Basically, the article focused on the role of the Israel lobby, as it was described, and its influence from their perspective in a very negative sense on American foreign policy. The article was criticized by many as being quite shoddy in terms of the approach taken and the academic perspective offered. And others viewed it as, in a sense, much ado about nothing. That is, certainly the Israel lobby for many years has tried to influence American policy, and in some cases has succeeded, in other cases it has failed, but it has basically played within the democratic rules of our system, and why should that be the subject of much criticism? A second controversy emerged around the publication of a book by President Carter, former President Carter, about 7 months ago. And again, I'm sure you've all been reading about this controversy. I had the privilege, or have had the privilege, of working with President Carter in his role as an election observer going back to the late 1980s. And I know him as a person of very serious intentions and very committed to human rights and democratization. I found the book, after reading it carefully, to be nuanced in a way that I didn't think was quite fair, particularly from an Israeli perspective. But at the same time, I thought that he was not given credit for the conclusions that he was promoting or proposing, which were very similar to what one finds as part of the debate and discussion that is ongoing in Israel. His recommendations very much are in accord with what was presented as the Geneva Initiative in 2003, and indeed follows that very closely. The other major development of the past year was obviously the war in Lebanon last summer, which clearly, again, polarized some of the discussions about Israel and about its prosecution of the war, focusing both on the question of how the war was being prosecuted, as well as whether it should have been prosecuted. That is, was Israel seen as simply defending itself from not only the kidnapping of the two soldiers, but also from the reality of Hezbollah's presence in southern Lebanon, or was it using this as some excuse to try and, again, reshuffle the Middle East power structures? And I'm sure you can tell me from discussions here on the UC Santa Barbara campus and elsewhere on college campuses of the different types of discussions that have gone on around Israel over the past year, and again, some of which have been quite polarizing. Indeed, some worry today whether it's possible to have a rational discussion about Israel in the United States. My chavura, where I attend services on Saturday mornings, posed this precise question of whether we could have a rational discussion about Israel, or whether inevitably one side or the other was going to view it as overly polemical in terms of how it was presented. You have on one hand an Israel that is seen by its partisans as a very successful but besieged country, successful in the sense that it's high per capita income, a developed country of the first order, a technological powerhouse, a large and powerful and well-regarded military. Yet despite peace treaties with Egypt and Jordan, Israel is still under threat from its neighbors, particularly, as I said, Hezbollah. Clearly, Hamas in the last year has proven again to be willing and able to use military rockets to threaten southern Israel, and the more ominous threat, obviously, from Iran and from the ruling authorities there. More generally, countries in the region and indeed around the world in many cases have continued to refuse to recognize Israel as a legitimate member of the international community. The consequence is a high level of schizophrenia among American Jews. They are proud of Israel's successes, but fear for the future. And then you have another narrative, another discussion that also is featured in many of the media. And in this narrative, Israel is illegitimate because it is based on ethnicity. It is acting illegally under international law because it continues to occupy the West Bank and Gaza. And it is an egregious abuser of human rights because of its practices, particularly in the West Bank and Gaza. And again, you hear this in various academic circles, but also within various international organizations. The discussions, for example, in the Human Rights Council that was established less than 2 years ago, in part to replace what was viewed as a commission on human rights that had gone off the wrong end in terms of trying to protect human rights, has again focused extensive attention on Israel and ignored some of the more serious human rights problems around the world. So let me offer a vision, but before doing so, just give you a little bit of a sense of where I'm coming from so you can better appreciate what I'm going to say. As Leonard said in the introduction, I am the executive director of the New Israel Fund. The fund was established in 1979 by a couple of Bay Area philanthropists, and it was designed very much as a partnership between diaspora Jews and Israelis. From the outset, the New Israel Fund saw itself as supporting Israeli organizations committed to transforming Israel into the type of society envisioned by Israel's Declaration of Independence and is influenced by the ancient prophets of Israel. Thus, from the beginning till today, the New Israel Fund supports the development of Israeli civil society through grants and training that is aimed at helping the more marginalized elements of society and buttressing human rights and social justice causes within the society. So what is the vision that comes out of this perspective that I'm sharing, and how does it relate to what is of concern to us as American Jews? There are two basic principles that I view as critical to understanding Israel. One is Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, and the second is Israel as a progressive and tolerant state. What do I mean by a Jewish and democratic state? I mean, this has become the subject of much controversy. I, for one, don't see the inherent conflict between Jewish and democratic. I think the two can coexist and have coexisted in other societies where you have a dominant religion or a state-recognized religion, but still have been able to develop democratic practices. And I think this is the goal that Israel strives for and in many respects has achieved, despite the fact that, like all democracies, Israel too has flaws. The three components that I want to talk about in this regard is, first of all, Israel as a pluralist state, and this focuses on the Jewish side of the equation. Israel needs to respect that there are different forms of Judaism and should not enshrine a single form as defining what Judaism is. And here I think Israel has much to learn from the American Jewish experience, where we have, in a sense, reveled in the fact that different forms of Judaism, whether different streams, Orthodox, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Reform, Renewal, can all work together as part of communities and engage with each other, even as they differ on certain issues. And I think Israel has a long way to go in this respect, although there has been progress over the last decade. A second challenge to Israel's democracy is its treatment of minorities. And again, this is an issue that goes back to the, in a sense, the founding of the state. Israel has a Jewish majority, but it also has a very significant Arab minority. Today, that Arab minority is approximately 20% of the population, which is a significant minority in a democratic state. The Arab population in Israel has experienced different types of discrimination. For the first 18 years after independence, the Arabs were subject to a form of military rule. These are Arab citizens of Israel. They were entitled to vote, but they had restrictions on their ability to move around the country. Again, as compared to other countries in the regions, one could say that the Arab population in Israel has done well. and certainly the socioeconomic indicators for the Arab minority in Israel is better than many of its neighboring countries. But as would be the case in this country, the comparison is not to neighbors for a minority group, but is a comparison to fellow citizens. And here the Arab minority compares very unfavorably to the Jewish population in Israel, again in terms of basic socioeconomic realities. In October 2000, the community suffered a major shock at the time of the outbreak of the First Intifada. There were protests in the Arab communities, particularly in the Galilee, and as a consequence of what was viewed by the Israeli Commission as an inappropriate response, 12 Israeli Arabs were killed by Israeli police. As I indicated, the events were investigated by a state inquiry commission known as the Orr Commission, and it produced a volume of information regarding the situation of the Israeli Arabs, and a number of very important recommendations. Unfortunately, many of those recommendations have yet to be implemented, and still, but still are debated. There have been a couple of recent developments that I just want to mention that I think are important in the context of minority rights in Israel. The first is that in the last 6 months, there have been a number of documents that have emanated from the Israeli Arab community. The most notable of one is called the Future Vision. And basically, they lay out a vision as they see Israel evolving and evolving in its treatment of the Arab minority. It has been quite controversial. On some of the issues, it's pretty straightforward in terms of dealing with issues like housing and employment and economic opportunities. But in terms of its opening prologue, it raises various questions about the nature of the state of Israel that has provoked a strong response from many in the Jewish community. However, what it has provoked in a very positive sense has been a dialogue. And the good example of how that has developed was about 2 weeks ago, Prime Minister Olmert hosted a day-long seminar to discuss minority rights in Israel with the authors of this document as well as other Jewish intellectuals. And again, there's now hope for follow-up. A second example of what I view as a positive development just on this specific issue has to do with the American Jewish community. For many years, this issue of minority rights in Israel was not particularly relevant to the organized American Jewish community. To the extent that it came up within organizations like the New Israel Fund. But about 2 years ago, an interagency task force was formed that actually covers a wide spectrum of the organized American Jewish community. Just to give you an example, the steering committee of this task force includes the New Israel Fund, but also includes the Anti-Defamation League and the Conference of Presidents. And the task force itself includes a whole list of very mainstream organizations. And the consequence has been quite significant. It has made legitimate discussions about minority rights within the American Jewish community. And I think it had a profound effect during the war in Lebanon last summer when there was a question of who should be helped in terms of support for Israel. Should it be just the Jewish community or should it be all Israelis? And again, the fact that there was a task force and that there had been some consciousness-raising over the past couple of years, I think, informed that discussion and made it much more comfortable for those who are desirous of supporting Israel in general as opposed to focusing only on the Jewish community. The third challenge to Israeli democracy has been, again, the consequences of the occupation of the West Bank and until 2005, the Gaza Strip. It has caused continued violence between Palestinians and Israelis with resulting loss of life, injuries, and severe economic disruptions, particularly for the Palestinians. In terms of Israel, it has resulted in a misallocation of resources in developing the settlements and neglecting, in many cases, the needs of the marginalized populations within Israel. And has also caused a growing psychological callousness on the part of the Israeli population. The lack of concern regarding what is going on next door. And I can remember from my time living in Israel, and again, I was focused, obviously, on what was happening in the Palestinian territories, but would be physically interacting with friends in Tel Aviv and Herzliya, where I lived. And again, what was going on 30, 40 miles away was completely outside of their focus, and I think that's not a healthy attitude. And obviously, you also have the issues of human rights abuses that have been documented by various Israeli organizations. And these include issues of torture, administrative detention, and abuse at checkpoints. And again, these obviously take place in Israel, but they have consequences in terms of how the American Jewish community relates to these issues. So that's on the Jewish and democratic side. In terms of a progressive and tolerant state, the goal is equitable opportunities for all, and yet what we've seen in the last 15 years or so are growing socioeconomic gaps. Israel now has either the first or the second largest gap between rich and poor in the developed world. And before you become too critical of Israel, you should know that you're living in the country that has probably the largest gap between rich and poor. Education system. Again, Israel always prided itself on its education system. Again, in the last decade, according to international tests of that are conducted in developed countries of scores from students, Israel now ranks at the bottom end of the spectrum in terms of its education system. And it also has severely compromised what used to be a very progressive social welfare system and created one that's quite harsh for those who are, again, at the bottom of the economic spectrum. In terms of tolerance, again, there has been some progress in terms of addressing issues of racism and homophobia. But again, these issues, like in many countries, persist and require constant vigilance. These are, and here I want to stress, these are issues clearly of internal concern to Israelis, but they reflect on the relationship between Israel and the diaspora communities. From an Israeli perspective, what's needed is to strengthen Israel's formal institutions. There's been a debate about the need for a constitution and whether that's a way to protect fundamental rights in Israel. What we've seen elsewhere in the world is that it's very hard to develop a new constitution in a developed country. usually the time to develop a constitution is right after independence or a major transition. But once the country is settled in, interests become quite protective of their particular issues, and developing a fundamental document like a constitution becomes a major challenge. There's also the issue of electoral reform. Again, here Israel has actually tried this, had a major electoral reform in the 1990s, conducted two elections with the reform system, and decided that it didn't work, and so went back to the system that had been in place since the formation of the state. Again, it's very hard to change electoral systems for obvious reasons. The incumbents don't like to shift things in a dramatic manner, particularly if it would affect their ability to win elections again. The third formal institution that's quite critical is the independent judiciary. And again, Israel has had a independent judiciary for a number of decades, a very powerful judiciary in many respects, so powerful that it too has become a source of criticism, and efforts have been proposed, including most recently by the Minister of Justice, to actually take away some of the independence of the judiciary. And again, this is an issue that I think is a cause for concern and deserves attention. In addition to strengthening the formal institutions, there's the need to maintain an empowered civil society. This is where organizations like New Israel Fund come in. But we need to think about what civil society does. First, it fills gaps in service provision. Again, the state cannot be and is not capable of being responsible for assuring that the social welfare needs of the population are met, and so often civil society fills key gaps. It monitors abuses, and again, Israeli civil society, including an independent media, has been very good at accomplishing this goal. And civil society also needs to advocate for social change. And again, my view is that in Israel, civil society is in relatively good shape, but there's always the question of how to maintain the type of activist groups that promote social change on a regular basis. The third key issue in terms of the Israeli scene is how to negotiate or to put the emphasis on negotiating peace between Israel and its neighbors. On the Palestinian side, many believe that the outline of an agreement between Palestinians and Israelis is there, whether it's the Clinton parameters that were developed at the end of President Clinton's term in office in 2000, or the Geneva Initiative that was developed through negotiations between non-governmental Israelis and non-governmental Palestinians. There's a very elaborate discussion of how the core issues would be resolved. Again, obviously what's needed is for the parties themselves to do the negotiations and to agree on them, but the basic issues have been much discussed and probably with some solid leadership and good intentions, the remaining gaps could be overcome. Similarly, the gaps between Israel and Syria are probably less than might be imagined, even though it's been very difficult to get the parties to even sit down together in a formal setting as opposed to unofficial settings. What's missing is the political will. And while peace is imperative and needs to be focused on, Israel also has to address the internal issues that I referred to. And the same is true for the Palestinians. And again, from my experience working in the Palestinian territories for 5 years, I can tell you that the need for democratic institutions there and for an empowered civil society are absolutely critical. Let me return to the relationship between Israel and the diaspora and make four points. First, Israel should not be excluded from Jewish consciousness. There's some concern that one reads about in various surveys that are conducted of the American Jewish community, that there's growing disaffection or apathy, particularly among younger Jews, when they think about and talk about Israel. It's not universal, and again, programs like Birthright have certainly helped to strengthen the connection. But the data is showing a growing disaffection. My point would be whether your starting point is tikkun olam, or spiritual seeking, or just looking for community, Israel should remain an integral part of the equation for American Jews. That is, it's not enough simply to do your Jewishness through these other mechanisms, but Israel, in one way or another, has to fit into the process. Our experience as Americans is relevant to discussions that go on in Israel, but clearly, since we live here, they cannot be definitive or positive. Second point about the relationship, debate is good. We should not shy away from discussion about Israel nor feel overly defensive. Israel has its flaws, as does any democracy. And again, when we look at what's going on in this country, we can highlight many of the flaws in our democracy and efforts to curb civil liberties, some of the debates we're having about corruption. This is part and parcel of the democratic system. Israel has its flaws, but again, this is not a reason not to talk about Israel or to fear discussions about Israel. We can contribute as diaspora to a better future for Israel. We can model behaviors in our own communities that can then be used by those in Israel and the region as examples. And again, I think a lot of the work that's being done today with respect to Jewish-Muslim dialogue or Jewish-Arab dialogue is very important and can provide a useful model for the future relations between Israel and its neighbors. We should also support those in Israel and other countries in the region who are promoting the values that we hold dear as Americans. And here I speak specifically about civil rights. I think, again, our experience in the 1960s and 70s is useful as an example for Israel. And then the last point is we should continue to view peace in the region as critical. We should advocate, not be afraid to advocate, for the vision that was articulated by President Bush in June 2002, where he talked about, actually for the first time as an American president, a Israel and Palestine living side by side in peace. That should be the vision, and that should be what we focus on and encourage. And we should understand that peace, when it happens, will be costly from a political perspective, a financial perspective, and a psychological perspective. So let me close with where I began in terms of what I see happening. First, I do see a much more mature relationship evolving with American Jews' understanding of Israel and the broad spectrum of realities that are part of Israeli life. And I think this relationship that's evolving will focus more on the partnership, which again was one of the founding principles of the New Israel Fund when it began in 1979, a partnership between Israel and the diaspora. And that's what I hope will continue to move forward and will create a better society for Israel and also strengthen the relationship between American Jews and Israel. Thank you very much. Okay, this side and then this side.
Hi. Having never been to Israel and not quite knowing the situation there. I was wondering if there's a cooperation between the Israeli government and the Arab community there, the minority there, whether they're working in cooperation in terms of bettering their situation there. You mentioned a council of Israelis in terms of trying to help out their situation there. Is there a hand-in-hand action there, or what is that situation? Are Arabs encouraged to step up and form communities, or what is that situation there?
It's a very complicated issue, but a very important issue, as I tried to stress in my presentation. The current situation is, I mean, at a formal level, I mean, the Israeli Arab minority are citizens of the country. As I said, they constitute approximately 20% of the country, of the population. They have the right to vote. They have the right to all the same services as the Jewish majority. But when it comes to the distribution of basic services, it's often done in a less than equitable manner. Let me give you a very specific example, which has both the positive, the negative and the positive built into it. About 6-7 years ago, the Israeli government came up with a system of awarding allocations, resource allocations to communities, towns, based on a preference system. And lo and behold, the preference system resulted in 500, and it was supposed to be based on a preference system that would help the less developed towns and communities. And the outcome was that out of the 550 communities that were designated for these preferences, 550 were Jewish communities and 4 were Arab communities. It's the bad news. The good news is that a case was brought challenging this policy of the government. And after several years of litigation, the case was resolved in a very far-reaching decision by the Israeli High Court, basically saying that that type of inequitable allocations were discriminatory on their face, and the government had to change the policy if it wanted to keep the system. So there are efforts underway to address this. It's slow. You know, again, you'd find today, by comparing socioeconomic trends, that the Arab population is still well behind the Jewish population. But in some, among some of the subgroups of the Arabs, the gaps are shrinking. So, for example, among Arab Christians, the gaps are considerably less than they are between Jews and Arabs than they are between Jews and Arab Muslims. So there is some discussions about it, but clearly from our perspective, a lot more needs to be done. Go ahead.
Sorry, you spoke about the fact that the Israeli government was not necessarily infringing upon the rights of the Arab citizens, but let's say curtailing some of the benefits that they would, that Israeli citizens would normally gain. But my question is actually two parts. I'm not aware. Maybe you can help me. Is there one Arab or Muslim country that grants citizenship to Jews or allows them to partake in government policy, which I know Israel does, of Arabs, because there is an Arab coalition in the government? And secondly, how does one go about creating peace, which is so important, with a person or a country who doesn't recognize their existence?
In terms of Arab countries, you know, since the State of Israel is founded, there's been a mass exodus from most Arab countries, but there are still Jews living in several Arab countries. Morocco, well, Iran's not an Arab country, but Morocco, Tunisia, Yemen, even Syria have small Jewish communities. again, they believe are viewed as citizens of the country, but they are viewed as citizens of the country. But no, I'm sure they're allowed to vote. But again, voting doesn't mean all that much in many of these countries. The Moroccan government had for many years a leading advisor to the king was a Jewish citizen of Morocco. So I mean, again, it's not a positive story, but it's not that there are no Jews left or they're all deprived of their citizenship in all the Arab countries. In several, it's true. In terms of how do you make peace with people who don't recognize you, it's very difficult, and probably you can't. And clearly, the fundamentals of the discussions with the Palestinians certainly has always been about recognition of Israel. That was sort of a fundamental principle of the Oslo Accords, that the Palestinians did recognize Israel. And that's been the challenge in terms of dealing with Hamas right now. Until the election in 2006, you had the Palestinian Authority recognizing Israel, dealing with Israel on a day-to-day basis, as well as in a legal format under the Oslo Accords. You then had an election in which Hamas won a plurality of the votes and won a majority of the seats in their legislative council and formed a government. And Hamas clearly is committed to, at least at this point, not recognizing Israel formally. And it has created a major problem. Now, from my perspective, one of the positive developments was the formation of a national unity government and the recognition that the negotiations would be handled by President Abbas, who has the legitimacy both of being president, of an elected president, but also the legitimacy of being the head of the PLO. So there is a basis for negotiations, and hopefully, the keeping Hamas as part of the unity government would make it possible for the peace negotiations to hold. Obviously, what's happened the last month has been quite distressing, and it now looks more doubtful that that would be the outcome.
Your talk, which was so interesting, was entitled The Post Hava Nagila Vision. Could you say something about what the Hava Nagila vision was and when it held sway, why it fell, and whether it was ever and rooted in reality, and if so, how much?
I think the Hava Nagila version was the romanticized version many attribute, would associate with the Exodus movie or book that many of us read in the 1960s, of an Israel that was this wonderful egalitarian-oriented society, the kibbutz model, even in the good old days, very few people lived in the kibbutzim. It was part of Israel that, I don't want to say could do no wrong, but was not the positives well outweighed the negatives. When that began to change, I mean, I think certainly through the 1967 war that image prevailed. I think starting with the 1973 war, there began to be some reconsideration. But it was a slow process, and I don't know, I mean, I don't think there's any specific point that we could say we went from the Hava Nagila to the post-Hava Nagila, But I think there has been a maturing, what I would say, of the relationship, which is what I think represents the current status. That is a much deeper appreciation of what Israeli realities are, and not simply what we thought it was 40 years ago.
You mentioned the growing socioeconomic gap in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
How much does that have to do with the growing ultra-Orthodox population who doesn't work?
First of all, doesn't work is probably not the way I would put it. But clearly, that's an issue. I don't think the gap, the magnitude of the gap, is a result solely of that, you know, the fact that the ultra-Orthodox either work less or are in jobs that are less well-paid, or that there's only one breadwinner in a family. But clearly, I mean, if you look at the Israeli socioeconomic scene, the people who are at the bottom levels are the ultra-Orthodox and the Arab minority. And again, for the sociologists or the development specialists, one of the attributes that both those communities have are large families. And the correlation between, you know, family size and socioeconomic status is not only true in Israel, but it's true in lots of developing countries. Indeed, one of the explanations of why the gap between Jews and Arab Christians has gone down in Israel can be explained from this demographic reality. That if you look at the birth rates within the Arab Christian community, it is coming very close to the Israeli Jewish community. And therefore, the consequence is that other socioeconomic indicators are also becoming closer. But in the ultra-Orthodox community, where, you know, families of 8, 9, 10 children are common, it makes it much more difficult, and the challenges are obvious. Okay, one or two more questions, and then we'll close. Rich, you want a second crack?
So we often hear, among our detractors, we saw it in Carter's book, that there's a very open and free discussion in the media and society in Israel about these issues, and then in the Jewish community in America, that discussion is stifled. And so I wonder if you could respond to that, specifically in terms of your organization, since you're both involved in Israel and here. What's that reaction like?
I mean, first of all, I certainly agree that there's a free and open debate in Israel about these issues. A very lively debate, and it doesn't always end up where, you know, I would like, or where, you know, we institutionally would like. But you cannot deny that debate exists about all these issues, everything from, you know, the Jewish and democratic nature of the state to the questions relating to Israel's policies in the West Bank. To questions relating to Israel's policies with its other neighbors. In terms of the United States, one of the reasons I like speaking at programs like this is because, living in Washington, we often have a very false sense of reality. And my impression from living in Washington that the stifling of the debate is somewhat a mirage. I mean, I don't see it. We have discussions all the time about policies. We share an office with Americans for Peace Now, which is very active in pushing issues in Congress. And so there are different voices that are heard, within the American Jewish community on issues relating to Israel. And I, certainly hear them and participate in them. You know, we get criticized, but, you know, fair game. But I am curious that there seems to be this perception of a closed discussion about issues relating to Israel, and that, as I said, you cannot have a rational debate about Israel, that if a Jimmy Carter comes out with a book, he's immediately criticized. I mean, I think the reaction has been indeed the opposite. I mean, you know, he's invited to Brandeis, he's invited to Berkeley, he's speaking all over, he's involved in a discussion. I mean, not everyone has to accept his perspective on the situation. I have my own critiques of his book, but, you know, he certainly has given voice to a perspective that deserves to be heard. So I get a little, you know, bewildered when I hear about the stifling of the debate. And, you know, I think that becomes another way of carrying out the debate, to say that so-and-so is stifling the debate. I think debate is important. It's certainly from, you know, the Jewish tradition, I think, an essential component of it, and I think we all should feel gratified to have an opportunity to discuss issues of such importance with a wide variety of interlocutors.
Please, let's all thank Larry Garber. We very much appreciate the opportunities given us to look carefully at Israeli domestic society, because so often the presentations focus on its foreign affairs, and we felt that this would be especially helpful for students who may not have visited or may have visited in a very, very limited capacity. And we invite you to have further conversations with Larry, and also to find out more about the activities of the New Israel Fund, which he tells me offers opportunities now for students to get involved in programs, and which they're committed to doing. So I hope you'll join him this evening and talk to him before you all take off. And thank you very much for coming. See you next fall.